Good morning.
As we did yesterday, we began the day with a short meditation. So we'll do something similar
this morning.
The purpose of the second part,
after we've calmed the mind by watching the breath,
then the purpose to try to observe the mind itself, the continuum of awareness, is to become familiar with checking up or being mindful of our mind. It's we don't have the habit.
Well, I don't.
Most of us don't have the habit of checking our mind to see how it looks, how it appears. I think all of us, in the morning, before we go out to work or to study or wherever we're going, we check the mirror to check our body. Right? Now, how does the body look? Is the hair straight, is clean, etc.? This is our presentation of me to the world, my body, my face, etc. And we go to all lengths to try to make the presentation of our body attractive, likeable. From simply washing, to applying makeup, to spending large amounts of money at the plastic surgeons. Feeling how important it is to present one's physical appearance as oneself. But when we meet people, their physical appearance is one factor, but whether we really like them or not is what we can glean from their mental state. If somebody's mind is genuine, interested in us and what's going on, sincere, not living at a level of pretense, but genuine, we can pick it up. We can pick up affection. We can pick up suppressed aggression. We can pick up pride. We can pick up the qualities of another person's mind. And that's how we judge them as an individual. Even those with the most attractive face, attractive body, etc., you know, worthy of being in a magazine or in a fashion parade, if they show signs of selfishness, greed, arrogance, competitiveness, we dismiss their physical appearance and we tend to dismiss the person because of what we read in their mind. That's reality. We know that. But how often do we, in the morning, before we go out, do we generally check up what's happening in the mind? Now, we can't help our genetic inheritance from our parents. We either have a conventionally attractive body or not. We certainly do try to modify the flaws in our appearance, hide them, get them surgically altered, etc., etc. But there's a limit to what we can do to make our bodies appealing or attractive. We also have inherited a whole lot of mental qualities from past lives. Some good qualities, some bad qualities. But every mental quality, whether it's good or virtuous or bad or non-virtuous, is changeable. It can be without paying any money, without buying expensive makeup or whatever, we can transform the inherited qualities of our mind by eliminating the unattractive ones and cultivating the attractive qualities of mind. So this is the meditation on first stabilizing the mind, watching the breath, and then looking at the flow of consciousness, the mind itself. It's very important. Fundamentally, we can recognize the peaceful and still nature of the mind as it flows through time, this continuum of awareness, which is mind. So that peace is natural. It's not fabricated. It's always there, but it's usually obscured by mental activity, by concern, self-consciousness, worry, how am I doing, this, that, unhappy, depressed, anxiety, and so on. It never has a chance to manifest. But if we consciously still the mind, watching the breath, it gets a chance. That's the foundation, the base. Having recognized that foundation, then we can build upon that, make that foundation really appealing and attractive. So there are many meditations which the lamas teach us to cultivate loving kindness, compassion, patience, and so on. Attractive qualities of mind. Love is the mental, just the mental attitude of delight in another person's happiness and wanting the other person to be happy with no strings attached. And as I mentioned yesterday, young babies and children require love from anybody, usually from mother, father, close relatives. They require love for both their physical and their mental development, maturation. Love is a form of nourishment, a psychological nourishment for little children. So it's a good starting point for training our mind to be attractive. So in our meditation, if we reach the point of stillness, relative peace, and I say the actual peace and stillness is something a bit beyond our imagination, it's attainable, but simply a few minutes watching the breath can give us a hint, a taste of the natural quality of consciousness. So on that foundation, we generate our mind in the aspect of love. And you know, obviously, to generate love, we think of those persons who are closest to us, who have given us so much care and attention and helped us, usually mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, close relatives. So we think of their kindness, we generate our mind in the aspect of love towards them. And then by extension, we can go further and further out. They are all humans. They look after their children, their friends, with kindness and so on. And even further, they have been like my present mother to me in past lives. So they're worthy objects of our love. Even the most harmful. You know, people you read about in the newspapers, mass murderers and so on, they are still worthy objects of love. And then beyond that, there's all the animals, and birds, and fish, and insects and so on. Now they happen to be in that body covered in fur or scales. But in the past they were humans, and we were animals. And also in the past they've been our mother and father. So even the creatures, other than humans, are worthy of our love. So, having generated our mind in the aspect of love towards mother or father, it can be expanded. So we meditate on that, expanding our mind to become all comprehensive, including every living being. That is a valid exercise. Remember, was it yesterday? I think I was mentioning that the mental consciousness, which is our meditating mind, you know, as opposed to the five sense consciousnesses, the mental consciousness itself is neither virtuous or non-virtuous. But it becomes totally virtuous or totally non-virtuous according to what mental factor may be manifesting. So we all have the seeds of love, we have the seeds of compassion and so on, but they're not necessarily manifest. We have the seeds of selfishness, of anger, of pride and jealousy, but they're not necessarily manifest. But at any one moment, when either a virtuous attitude, say of love, or a non-virtuous attitude of anger, is the seed is manifesting, that will colour the entire mind, the entire mental consciousness, as being virtuous or non-virtuous. So that the attitude or the appearance, if we look in the mirror of the mind, is that a valid metaphor? Anyway, when our mind has manifest love, it is an entity or which can be picked up by others. Not necessarily, depending upon their mental attitude. If they are angry at us, dislike us, that can completely blind their intuitive awareness of where we're at, and they'll see us as their enemy. No matter what we do, if we try to help them, they'll interpret, oh, they're trying to cheat me, get at me, you know. That's their problem. We can't get into their mind directly. Indirectly, maybe, but not directly. But we can get into our own mind directly. So this is what we should do regularly, especially in the morning, preparation for the day, to consciously, just as we consciously clean our face, comb our hair, put on makeup, whatever, we should, and there could be some resistance, you know, our mind doesn't want to meditate, it doesn't want to love everybody. I've got this awful boss at work who, I want to get even. We want to cleanse our mind of resentfulness, grudge bearing, which can go back a long way, and actively generate a mind in the aspect of love as the most important preparation for the day. Then, even if our clothes are a bit crumpled, our hair is messed up, it doesn't matter. The mind is pure. And to maintain it throughout the day is difficult but possible. So this is like the pep talk from the coach before we meditate. All right, so I'll describe it. as we go. So begin.
First, try to sit comfortably with your back straight. Rest your right hand, your left hand, thumbs together, elbows loose.
Hands in your lap. Your head slightly angled forward.
Mouth closed, breathing normally through your nose.
Eyes slightly open or very lightly closed. And breathing normally. Focus your entire attention with effort, holding awareness of the sensation of the air as it enters and leaves your nostrils with each breath. Try to maintain unbroken awareness of the inspiration and expiration at your nostrils. Now let go of your focus of attention on the breath and instead turn your awareness inwards and be aware of your mind itself, the stream of consciousness. And try to recognize the peaceful state, the natural quiet in your mind when the tendency to become involved in ideas and thoughts has settled down. And there's just this continuum of awareness, which is your mind, capable of experiencing all the different types of sense objects, capable of experiencing all the objects of knowledge, memory, and so on. But the moment in the state of peace and stillness, let your awareness abide in that natural quiet. Now think of the person who was most kind to you when you were young, helpless baby, a toddler, who looked after you, nourished you, protected you, and so on. Even we can't remember when we were very young. But the fact that we survived indicates that we were looked after with love. So usually our mother, think of her kindness, and as you do so, feel what we call the heartwarming love towards your mother arising in your heart. Just the pure thought, wishing her to be happy, delight in making her happy. Wherever she is, even if she's in her next life or still in this life, imagine you have heart-to-heart communication with your mother as you send the warm, healing energy of love from your heart to her heart. Feel great joy that in this way you are repaying her kindness towards you when you were very young. then think of all other living beings, those close, father, brother, sister, etc., friends, strangers, and even those who don't like you, all the beings in the animal realm and the other realms of rebirth. Seeing all as one universal family, your family, imagine as you radiate the warmth of love from your heart throughout the universe, touching the hearts of all living beings and bringing happiness. Think that the blissful energy from your heart has brought all mother sentient beings to enlightenment. Their environments have been transformed into pure lands. And then they and their environments all dissolve into the Dharmakaya wisdom of Buddhahood. And the blissful energy of love that has radiated from your heart, having completed its purpose, flows back into you, entering your body from every direction, filling your body as your mind in the aspect of universal love. And think that I've now made my mind perfect, the ideal presentation to everybody I'm going to meet today, tomorrow, for the remainder of this life, and all future lives until I achieve enlightenment. And then you can gradually relax and stop the meditation. That, you know, this is the way we prepare, we best prepare our mind for living, and it's the best way to prepare our mind for dying.
Right.
So dying is the topic of the day. As I mentioned yesterday, during the third stage of death, when we still have a degree of ability to distinguish between virtue, non-virtue. At that point, the karma for our future life will be germinated, will ripen. And if our mind is in a positive or virtuous attitude, that will be the ground or the soil which will nurture a virtuous karma for a happy rebirth. If our mind at that stage is upset, disturbed, in a non-virtuous attitude, that will be the soil which nurtures a non-virtuous karma which will ripen for an unhappy rebirth. So you see, we're dying, we're losing our mental faculties, but we still, at this point, this third stage of death, have a degree of control, of understanding. Once the third stage finishes, the karma's ripened, and we slip into death, the fourth and fifth stages, without being able to turn back, without being able to change our karmic destiny. So this is, you know, for most people. Yes, in Dhamma there are practices within Tantra whereby we can change the destiny in the later stages of death, even in the bardo, the intermediate state. But it's very, very rare for anybody to be able to do that, or to have the great fortune to have a teacher who, through her or his meditational power, can assist us. If we have that, then good, it can help. But it's much better to do it ourselves. We never know when we'll die. We should always be prepared for death at any time. As my story yesterday, when Namazobe Rinpoche gave me his watch, and he said he'd always intended to paint on the dial, now is the time to die. So often we check the time to see whether it's time for lunch or time to go home or whatever. That is the superficial time, but every moment, the time to die could be 8 o'clock in the morning, 9, 10, 11, 12, or afternoon, any moment. We will die, and we don't know when. Death won't wait until knock-off time, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the afternoon. It comes when our karmic lifespan is finished. So, I described fairly quickly the five steps of death yesterday afternoon, beginning with the presentation, which comes from the Vajrayana texts, of the subtle relationship between the body and the mind. How, in the tantric meditations, there's a presentation of the channels and the chakras and the winds and the drops, energies and so on within the body. Now, if we can't reveal those structures with our scalpels and our microscopes, that does not negate their existence. What verifies their existence is that this presentation of channels, chakras and so on is like it is a map for meditators. It gives each individual meditator the instructions on where to focus their attention on their body. So we can go to all sorts of comparisons. Having a general understanding of anatomy and physiology, I thought, wow, this is really interesting. At each chakra, there are important endocrine glands, you know, these glands of the body, which secrete hormones, which have a very powerful influence upon the state of mind. And, oh yes, there's the pituitary, there's the thyroid, the thymus. Oh yes, there's so many abdominal endocrine glands. There's the organs in the pelvis. Yes, that must be it. It must be the chakras. And there's the nervous system. We know from just observation the relationship between the activity of the nervous system, the peripheral nerves, central nervous system, in terms of our psychological experience. Very interesting. But I came to the conclusion, well, I don't need to identify the gross equivalence of this presentation of channels and chakras. The channels and chakras are very simple, very clear forward. And what verifies their reality is the meditational experience of the countless yogis and yoginis over the centuries who have followed the instructions of the text, meditated upon the channels and chakras, and generated the results, including the result of enlightenment, of Buddhahood. Final attainment of Buddhahood necessarily involves meditating on entering the wind energies into this visualized central channel of generating what we took, the white experience, the red experience, the black experience, and especially the clear light experience. So, the active experiential verification is what's important. The correlation between what we know about anatomy is interesting. And I think definitely related, for sure. But the exact relationship, well, okay. Nice. Might get a Nobel Prize, but I don't want a Nobel Prize. I want enlightenment. And so theoretically, yeah, interesting. But experientially, that's what's important. We mentioned during the first four steps there are inner visions associated with the winds coming closer, entering the central channel, the mirage-like vision, the smoke, room full of smoke vision, the blackness with the red sparks, then the single point of light, and then there's the white vision. So I think on the third page, I mentioned the 22nd stage of the 25 stages of time, the white drop descending. So as we explained yesterday, at that stage you've stopped breathing, and the winds from the upper part of the body are entering the central channel, flowing down towards the heart chakra, and they carry white drop energy from the crown chakra towards the heart. And it says there is the vision of white appearance occurs like moonlight in a clear sky, empty of true existence of the previous vision. So that phrase, empty of true existence of the previous vision, means that even those visions, mirage, room of smoke, sparks, point of light, they appear to the mind and they also have the false appearance of true existence or inherent existence. When we get to the white vision.
The previous vision was a pinpoint of light.
So that is now, that the mind has experienced that is empty of true existence. Now, unfortunately, this is not the realization of emptiness.
It's shunyata.
But that vision, that previous vision has ceased. And then the red vision is described like the color of a deep red sunset, empty of true existence of the white vision. So the white vision appeared to exist inherently or truly, but now it has ceased. And so that false appearance of inherent existence has ceased with the cessation of the white vision. So now it's a more subtle vision, the red vision. That red vision also as appearing as inherently existing. But then it ceases as all the winds become more and more and more subtle. They enter what I call yesterday the indestructible drop at the heart chakra, with a white substance on top, red below, like a capsule. And inside, the eternal drop, the most subtle, clear light, wind and mind. So, with the appearance of the black vision, they say black vision of near attainment is its full name. Like a totally dark tropical night. So now the red vision has ceased, and the appearance of inherent existence of the red vision has ceased. Doesn't mean we've realized emptiness, but that wrong appearance has ceased. The black vision is occurring. That also is appearing as existing inherently. False appearance. I mean, it's not true. The black vision does not exist inherently, but it appears to. Then that ceases, and the final vision of death, called the clear light, or the ground, what we call it, the ground nature of mind, manifests. That is the most subtle consciousness. The appearance of inherent existence of the black vision has ceased with the cessation of the black vision. At the clear light, there is no appearance of inherent existence. It appears to this most subtle appearance to the mind as it is. Unfortunately, that's not the wisdom realizing emptiness. But boy, it's so close. That is a fabulous time to meditate on emptiness when there's no appearance of inherent existence. And one of the main purposes of tantric meditation is to get to the clear light, to totally transform one's gross image of our gross body into the aspect of Buddhahood, in the aspect of one of the meditational deities. And then we can't explain the methods, because that would contravene the tantric vows. But the general purpose is to enter the winds into the central channel, experience the white, red, black visions, and meditate on the clear light. And then reverse. And so the tantric practitioner reverses and gets on with his or her life with a very different attitude. You know, we're allowed to say that in Tantra the most important aspect is to see oneself not ordinary, but it's called taking the result into the path, to see oneself as enlightened in the aspect of one's meditational deity. completely stop ordinary appearance. And then all of one's actions, one's thoughts, one's speech, one's physical actions, are the actions of the deity. And if we've done our meditation properly, and of course, you can't do this without bodhicitta. And the wisdom of understanding emptiness, and those two realizations are dependent upon renunciation, complete renunciation. And all three, renunciation, bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta, and the wisdom of realizing emptiness, are dependent upon calm abiding, shamatha, single-pointed concentration. If we haven't generated single-pointed concentration, we have not generated renunciation. We definitely have not generated bodhicitta, or the wisdom of understanding emptiness. I'm talking about the intellectual wisdom, not necessarily the direct wisdom, just the intellectual. So, although I've just outlined the way a tantric practitioner gets on with his or her life, we're in kindergarten. We should not be, you know, there's the term divine pride. Divine pride of seeing oneself in the aspect of Chinrezig or Tara, Vaishagini, you know, whatever deity we are practicing. It's like pride because it is consciously seeing oneself as a Buddha. And all sentient beings as the objects of one's love and compassion, as the purpose of one's existence. Buddhahood depends upon bodhicitta, right? Bodhicitta is the primary cause of Buddhahood. Bodhicitta, well, depends upon our teachers, but ultimately, bodhicitta depends upon sentient beings. If there were no sentient beings, there could be no universal compassion. No universal compassion, no bodhicitta. So the very purpose of Buddhahood is sentient beings. So divine pride, I am in the aspect of Tara or Chinrezig, whichever deity, is others. My whole being, my body, speech and mind are for the welfare of others. There is no other purpose for Buddhahood. So this death process is so important. Why? Because to achieve liberation, you know, nirvana, personal liberation, we need to abandon the obscurations or the obstacles to liberation, the afflictions based upon ignorance, anger, attachment, and all the different types of disturbing emotions. They and their seeds need to be abandoned. But still, upon achieving nirvana, there are still the obscurations to omniscience, to full knowledge, to the full capacity and power of Buddhahood. So those obscurations have to be abandoned, and they present as the appearance of inherent existence. These appearances are the obscurations to omniscience. So that have to be totally eradicated. So how do we eradicate the appearance of the subtle visions of death, the appearance of inherent existence or true existence? We can only achieve that abandonment by generating
those appearances,
and
which will appear as inherently existent,
then meditating on emptiness and extinguishing the false appearance of the white vision, red vision, black vision, and the clear light. There is no false appearance. So, tantric meditators can simulate the death process right up to the clear light and can reverse. So be very familiar with it. Then when actual death occurs, they're ready for it. These appearances are so subtle. They're not like lights in the sky. They're extremely subtle. We experience them every time we die. We get close to them every time we go to sleep. But they're so subtle, we're just incapable of being aware that they're happening. I mean, they are a form of awareness, but we're not subjectively aware. Okay. Now, I mentioned that the most subtle mind, the clear light awareness, supported by the most subtle wind, the clear light wind, abides at the center of what we call the indestructible drop at the heart chakra. The drop composed of the white, a drop energy from father, red from mother, forming like a capsule, which was formed at conception. The drop energies came from the sperm and the egg, and the consciousness, with its supporting wind, came from the bardo. So, this clear light mind, the Buddha's, the mind of Buddhahood, is always at the clear light level. It is never more coarse than that. At all times, when establishing the Pure Lands, when Shakyamuni Buddha was giving the 12 signs of his life and teaching the Dharma for so many years in India, at all times, Shakyamuni Buddha's mind was at the clear light. There is no conceptual activity whatsoever at the clear light. It is direct awareness of both conventional reality and ultimate reality, the two truths. Our human body and mind were the result of karma. The course, we talked about the five types of wind energy and associated consciousness with them. This coarseness, the coarsening of the wind, mind and wind together, is a result of karma. Karma and afflictions. Buddha has no karma, no afflictions. It cannot, the mind of the Buddhahood cannot go beyond the clear light. This eternal drop actually, you should listen to this. It's given the name eternal drop because it was never created, it will never end, and it changes moment by moment, and has been there in every life form that this mind has taken since the beginning of this time. We'll continue on until we eventually attain Buddhahood. And that will be the Buddha's, our future Buddha's mind and body. So, this eternal drop is one entity with two functions. One entity, two functions. It has the function of awareness, which we label mind. And it has the function of movement, which we label body. The two functions are different. Awareness and movement. Physical movement is the activity of the most subtle form element, the wind element. But as the winds become more coarse, you get the water element, fire element, earth element. I forget the order, but anyway, you get the manifestation of the other physical qualities. So it's not this eternal drop is the final basis of designation of the self. Remember, our person of this life is established in dependence upon the name the parents, our parents gave to the new baby. Little boy baby they called Tom, or whatever name you want to think of. Tom, the person Tom, came into existence when the parents decided to call their baby boy Tom. Prior to that event of labeling the name Tom onto the new baby, Tom did not exist. There was a new baby, but Tom didn't exist. Tom came into existence when the parents gave their baby that name. And everybody came to learn this new person's name. This little child is suitable to be called Tom. And so they related to the conventional person, Tom. At death, the body and mind separate. Tom ceases to exist. I mean, you know, in our cemeteries, whatever, we might label the name on the tombstone above the ashes or the body in the coffin, whatever. But really, that does not establish the person who is in the coffin. That person with that name has ceased to exist. There's no longer a valid connection between the name and the living body and mind. But the most subtle basis of labeling of the I or of the person is the eternal drop. And as the mind contracts, becoming more and more and more subtle, for us, our ordinary beings, our ordinary clear light mind, bears all of the karmic potencies, virtuous and non-virtuous, which have not yet ripened. It bears the seeds of all of the mental qualities, virtuous qualities, non-virtuous qualities, which are not manifest. And we see, there's this, during this fifth death stage of death, there's the cessation of the 80 primitive conceptions. Really interesting. The examples I took from a teaching given by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I've always wanted to know what are the others, as my interest in psychology. They must be listed somewhere. If anybody knows a source, let me know. Okay. So, although there is no, for us, when during death, when our mind reaches the clear light point, there is no appearance of inherent existence, our mind still carries the potencies, the karmic potencies, and as well as the seeds of the afflictions, as well as the imprints of the afflictions and the obscurations to omniscience. So, therefore, the continuity of that eternal drop, the most subtle wind of mind, which then leaves the body, and you get the coarsening of winds and minds, the bardo experience, that is the basis of the label I, or the person who goes from life to life. That is the connection between past actions and future results on the same person, changing moment by moment, the same person. You see, Tom, during his life, experiences a lot of horrible things. We all experience horrible and nice experiences, which is the ripening of karma from past lives. But Tom did not create, when Tom experiences karmas from past lives, Tom didn't create those karmas. Tom didn't even begin to exist until his parents gave him the name. It's not fair that these bad things happen to poor old Tom, who's been a good boy. But then something really horrible happens. No, Tom didn't create those causes. But the clear light mind that came from the past life bore with it the imprints. And that is unique. We don't share clear light minds. We can't transfer karmic potencies from one mind to another. They're born on a stream of consciousness, and there are innumerable streams of consciousness. We all have our unique streams of consciousness, which do connect us with past life experiences and past life actions, and which will connect experiences and actions of this life with future lives. This eternal drop, think about it. One entity, two functions, awareness and movement. One we label mind, the other we label body. This is the final meeting point of body and mind, going from life to life. So we can't escape actions of this life. We might try and bribe the police, etc. We might get away with certain bad behaviours from physical or social punishment, but unless we generate the four opponent powers to purify negative karma, we can't escape the karmic result of our actions in this life or future lives. Right. Okay, so that's where we ended up last night, at the point of death. As I said, in ordinary people, from the time we stop breathing, it can last up to 3 days, roughly they say, in an ordinary person. A meditator can hold the process and meditate on emptiness at the clear light stage for an extended period. And during that time, it's as if the body goes into, it doesn't decay. It stays suspended animation or whatever, I forget the term. And lamas have demonstrated this in India, especially when during the exodus of so many Tibetans and practitioners in the late 40s from Tibet into India, and many were old, many caught new diseases, TB, diarrhea and so on. So many died. And I haven't seen, but I've heard of many genuine examples where a meditator, a monk or a nun, would stop breathing but remain sitting in meditation. And the other friends would say to the medical, but don't touch him. And they stay without deteriorating, without decomposing for an extended period of time. And finally, there's a sign that the mind has left. And okay, now I can dispose of the body. In the Lum Room teaching, he says, we should be very careful with somebody dying. Don't touch them. It might interfere with their next life. Well, look, it might interfere with their next life if they're a meditator. But I doubt whether too many of us will be able to meditate as we're dying. As I said, you've got to have unbelievable power of concentration. And also, the karma has already ripened well before they stop breathing, when their aggregate of discrimination is weakening. It's ripened. So, whatever you do to an ordinary person, not talking about the meditator, as they're going through the death process, you know, when they stop breathing and so on, it's not going to make any difference to their future life. And I'm not talking about tantric practitioners of powa, that sort of stuff. Just ordinary people. People often ask, well, what about organ transplantation, donating organs? So, these questions are often asked. What do we do? What about turning off life support? How do we handle this situation? And so on. These questions were asked of a great lama, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, in the 1970s. The previous incarnation, who I met briefly in Kathmandu. And he replied to these questions. Donating organs is incredibly virtuous. The doctors, hopefully, don't take the organs, the heart out or the kidneys until, from their point of view, the person's dead. They've stopped breathing, their brain's not functioning. And so, if prior to your dying, if you had consciously given consent for your organs to be transplanted into a sick person, it's an unbelievably good karma. And even if the final visions of death have not finished, they will quickly occur, and death will occur, and there will be virtuous karma from the prior thought of giving one's organs, and the surgery of removing the organs will not affect the future life. Also, he said, the question about turning off life support. Is that murder? Is that the karma of killing? And his answer was, look, this person is dying. And the life support is keeping the body alive. Not sure about what's happening to the mind. The body's alive. But the person is dying, and when the life support is turned off, the person dies naturally. It is not the direct result of turning off the switch. So you do not create the karma of killing by switching off the life support. They die naturally. It's a natural death. Which is logical. I might think of all variations, but people get very upset, very worried. What do I do? Anyway, I was thinking of some other of that question and answer session, which I have notes of somewhere. Those are the two big questions that we so frequently ask. So, yeah.
Those who...
Yeah. Look, it's difficult. They're not dying, but they're in a coma. I think it varies in each situation. And we know medically that some people have been totally given up by the medical establishment, said to be in a vegetative state coma, actually are totally aware of what's happening, and there are methods of communicating. Like they can hear, and they can even, through their thoughts, they can, you know, with their instruments, these people can actively communicate with you by thinking. Incredible. One example is Geoffrey Hopkins. You know Geoffrey Hopkins? Unbelievable scholar and student of Tibetan Buddhism. And I heard one time he had Lyme disease. You know, this tick-borne parasite, rickettsia, whatever it is, in the United States. And he was in a coma. And he was totally conscious, but unable to communicate. And he actually heard the medical staff discussing the possibility of turning off the life support. He couldn't physically do anything, so mentally he was saying his mantras like crazy. Fortunately, he came out of the coma before they turned off the life support. And he was able to talk about it. So look, I can't give you a specific answer, but I think we should be careful. And we should use every means possible for those. We should, first of all, relate to a person in a coma as if they are fully awake and are aware of us. And this has been demonstrated. It's playing their favourite music, whatever, it seems to be apparently beneficial. I did it with a friend of mine. We went through medical school together, very close, and then he started slipping into Alzheimer's really, really badly, to the point where he no longer recognized me or his family, and required 24 hours care. So I said to his daughter, because see, we went through university in the 60s, right? Beatles, Rolling Stones, etc. So I said, look, get a CD of the Beatles and put the earphones on him and play it to him. And she said she did. And so Love, Love Me Do or something was being played. And she noticed that his, the only sign, his foot was tapping in rhythm to the beat of the song. So I believe that the person I knew, that mind was still there, unable to communicate, but receptive. Anyway, that's the best answer I can give. Okay, yeah. Sorry? Animals? Is it animals you're talking about? Yeah. Which are dying? Or? Oh, I see. Do you put them down? Well, I think it would be unskillful. Again, Lama Zoe Rinpoche has addressed these questions. Do we, a euthanasia of humans or animals? I can't exactly repeat his words, but he says something like, compassion is virtuous and is an overriding motivation. But it can be, even though there's great compassion, there can be ignorance of what exactly is going on. The dying animal or person could be experiencing the ripening of a negative karma, which will be exhausted during that difficult death experience. But through ignorance, we think, no, I can stop his suffering now by putting an end to its life. This is the most kind and compassionate thing to do. But not necessarily. We could be, that person or being could be experiencing the ripening of a karma which would have ripened as a hell realm rebirth. So if we interrupt the ripening by stopping the life, we could be sending the mind to experience a hell rebirth, which wouldn't have been experienced if they just completed that much lighter suffering as a human or as an animal. So, he says, there's the danger of ignorance contaminating our compassion. The best thing to do is to surround the dying animal or person with virtue, with virtuous mind and powerful mantras, reciting mantras, having holy objects, which act as conditions to allow the dying being to become virtuous. That is much more skillful. Okay. Yeah. I might be going to Alzheimer's, but I'm also going deaf. At the end of our life...
Yeah, yesterday you mentioned the length of our life.
Oh, yeah.
Has already been decided by our karmic influence.
Yeah, the lifespan is determined by karma.
Yeah. But why is it that our good deeds presently cannot affect...
Why can't the lifespan be extended? In general, that's the hand we were dealt. You can't make two aces, three aces. Well, if you're lucky with it. Everything about our life is a reflection of our karma. At a lecture at Melbourne University, Lama Yeshe, back in the mid-1970s, before I became a monk, I think, I was at this lecture. And somebody asked, it was just a general Dharma talk at Melbourne University, and I think Lama was talking about karma and so on. And a girl, she asked, she was in the front, and she said, "What is karma?" And Lama Yeshe, he said, "You are karma." And the lecture theatre went quiet. And this Australian guy at the back said, "I didn't understand the answer to that question." And Lama Yeshe said, "No, because the answer was for her, not for you. You understood, didn't you, dear?" And she said, "Yes." I'm not sure she did, because I didn't understand. Everything about us is karma. Even our lifespan. Yeah. If the dying person has fear
or confusion, like
confusion. Yeah.
Like blur. How do you help them activate virtuous thought?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, how do we help anybody who's unhappy and confused and they're not dying? It's difficult to help them, isn't it? The best way is to be peaceful, to be loving, to have a stable mind, and let them dump upon us. I'm talking about everyday life, not necessarily dying people. But it depends upon which stage you die. To let them express their fears and to be understanding, receptive, with kindness, with compassion, and with love. To be peaceful. In that way, simply by being, we can calm their mind. You know, at a funeral, if somebody's just died, and the family are gathering, and everybody's upset and distraught, and then a car pulls up, and it's Auntie so-and-so of the family. And everybody loves Auntie so-and-so because Auntie is so kind and peaceful and warm. And just the name, when we hear Auntie so-and-so's coming, makes everybody feel more relaxed. So that's the fundamental, the basic way to help somebody, whether they're dying or during life. Then, depending upon our prior relationship, if they admire us, if they respect us, and if we have good communication, we can suggest, you know, look at this image of Buddha, so on. There are many ways. When I spent 4 years in Mongolia teaching at our center there, and one of the students said her friend was in the, they had a special tuberculosis hospital. And tuberculosis at that time in Mongolia, it seemed like leprosy. You know, if somebody here, she got TB, you're kicked out of the family and nobody will visit you. It's like a horrible diagnosis. And there was a young woman who had been terminal diagnosis by the doctors. She was dying. It's so sad. Her family had abandoned her. And so she was just in this hospital room. And her friend, I didn't know her, but her friend said, what can we do? She did have faith in Dharma, because Mongolians, as they kept telling me, Buddhism is in our blood. I mean, they had 70 years of totalitarian suppression of Buddhism, much longer than Tibet. 70, and probably even heavier than what happened in Tibet. Anybody wearing robes was shot. There weren't nuns, there were monks, they were killed. In Tibet, they were able to escape to India. Anyway, that's a side issue. So I had a picture of Chinrezig Avalokiteshvara, forearmed. I gave it to a friend. I said, look, tell her to put it above her head in a hospital bed and to say, Om Mani Padme Hum, and to visualize for her, for the dying person, to visualize cleansing light from Chinrezig's heart, cleansing her of TB and everything. So she did that. Just 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks later, the friend came to me and said that her friend has been discharged from hospital, no sign of tuberculosis. Unbelievable. Well, unbelievable, the power of her conviction in the validity of Buddha Dharma and Chinrezig. So I was astonished, even though I said to this, I mean, I didn't know that this was going to happen. I hoped it would. And I know Lama Zopa Rinpoche has many examples of the power of mantra. So we do what we can according to the person's receptivity. Yeah.
People that
committed
suicides.
Sorry?
People that commit suicides.
I missed the thread.
Those people that committed suicides.
Oh, okay, yep. Commit suicide. So is the action of committing suicide, can this be a repetitive action from past lives or the result of karma or new afflictions in this life? Both. Both can happen. And it's difficult to say unless one has clairvoyance to really know what's going on in a person's mind. And there can be a whole spectrum of mental attitudes behind the decision to commit suicide. There can be virtuous motivation. There can be non-virtuous motivation. Shakyamuni Buddha, as a bodhisattva, gave his life to the tigers out of compassion, pure compassion and love. It's very, one cannot
be black and white and saying, declaring what's going on in the mind of a person who attempts suicide. I think in general, you know, there's a sense of hopelessness and meaninglessness in life, and depression, and maybe seeing oneself as a burden on others, or a potential burden on others, and no purpose. Or sometimes it can come from anger, wanting to hurt others by committing suicide. I think the whole mixture of different motivations. The first part of your question, yes, the tendency to repeat past actions is one form of karmic ripening. But in the specific instance of committing suicide, well, it may be an habitual behavior karmically acquired from past lives. Or it may not be. It may also be a new decision. Yeah, that's the general answer. Is that sufficient for your question, or you wanted something more deep? Or important. Very important, because it's becoming more and more common in our society. The whole world. Every country. More and more common. And for young people. It's common as cause for death in Australia, anyway. In young people. So sad. Sense of just meaninglessness and hopelessness. And it could be a whole sphere of discussion. But just general. It's not the only place where it's mentioned in the teaching on karma is that technically it's not the karma of killing to commit suicide. It's sort of I think next weekend is on karma, or the weekend after. But technically it's you don't create the karma of killing. Okay. All right, so we didn't get into the Bardo. This morning we're supposed to get into the Bardo, so we will after lunch. Thank you. And so whatever positive energy we've created together this morning, we dedicate that to all beings. Thank you.